Magic word? What's the magic word? The knocker perceptibly sneered. Have you been taught nothing, Miff? She drew herself up to her full height, which wasn't really worth the effort. She felt she'd had a trying day too. Her father had personally executed 100 enemies in battle. She should be able to manage a door knocker. I have been educated, she informed it with icy precision, by some of the finest scholars in the land. The door knocker did not appear to be impressed. If they didn't teach you the magic word, it said calmly, they couldn't have been all that fine. Kaylee reached out, grabbed the heavy ring, and pounded it on the door. The knocker leered at her. Freak me rough, it lisped. That's the way I like it. You're disgusting. Yes. Oh, that was nice. Do it again. The door opened a crack. There was a shadowy glimpse of curly hair. Madam, I said we're closed. Kaylee sagged. Please help me, she said. Please. See, said the door knocker triumphantly, sooner or later everyone remembers the magic word. Kaylee had been to official functions in Ankh-Morpork and had met senior wizards from Unseen University, the Disc's premier college of magic. Some of them had been tall and most of them had been fat, and nearly all of them had been richly dressed, or at least thought they were richly dressed. In fact, there are fashions in wizardry as in more mundane arts, and this tendency to look like elderly aldermen was only temporary. Previous generations had gone in for looking pale and interesting, or druidical and grubby, or mysterious and saturnine. But Kaylee was used to wizards as a sort of fur-trimmed small mountain with a wheezy voice, and Igneous Cutwell didn't quite fit the mage image. He was young. Well, that couldn't be helped. Presumably even wizards had to start off young. He didn't even have a beard, and the only thing his rather grubby robe was trimmed with was frayed edges. "Would you like a drink or something?" he said, surreptitiously kicking a discarded vest under the table. Kaylee looked around for somewhere to sit that wasn't occupied with laundry or used crockery, and shook her head. Cutwell noticed her expression. "It's a bit al fresco, I'm afraid," he added hurriedly, elbowing the remains of a garlic sausage onto the floor. "Mrs. Nugent usually comes in twice a week and does for me, but she's gone to see her sister who's had one of her turns. Are you sure? It's no trouble. I saw a spare cup here only yesterday." "I have a problem, Mr. Cutwell," said Kaylee. "Hang on a moment." He reached up to a hook over the fireplace and took down a pointy hat that had seen better days, although from the look of it they hadn't been very much better, and then said, "Right, fire away." "What's so important about the hat?" "Oh, it's very essential. You've got to have the proper hat for wizarding. We wizards know about this sort of thing."
"If you say so. Look, can you see me?"
He peered at her.
"Yes. Yes, I would definitely say I can see you."
"And hear me? You can hear me, can you?"
"Loud and clear, yes. Every syllable tinkling into place. No problems."
"Then would you be surprised if I told you that no one else in this city can?"
"Except me?"
Kaylee snorted.
"And your door knocker."
Cutwell pulled out a chair and sat down. He squirmed a little. A thoughtful expression passed over his face. He stood up, reached behind him, and produced a flat reddish mass, which might have once been half a pizza. He stared at it sorrowfully. The first pizza was created on the disc by the Clachian mystic Ronron Revelation Joe Shuwadhi, who claimed to have been given the recipe in a dream by the creator of the Discworld himself, who had apparently added that it was what he had intended all along. Those desert travellers who had seen the original, which is reputedly miraculously preserved in the forbidden city of E, say that what the creator had in mind then was a fairly small cheese and pepperoni affair with a few black olives and things like mountains and seas got added out of last-minute enthusiasm, as so often happens. After the schism of the Turnwise Ones and the deaths of some 25,000 people in the ensuing jihad, the faithful were allowed to add one small bay leaf to the recipe.
"I've been looking for that all morning, would you believe?" he said. "It was an all-on with extra peppers, too."
He picked sadly at the squashed shape, and suddenly remembered Kaylee.
"Gosh, sorry," he said. "Where's my manners? Whatever will you think of me? Here, Have an anchovy, please.
Have you been listening to me? Snapped Cayley.
Do you feel invisible? In yourself, I mean, said Cutwell, indistinctly.
Of course not. I just feel angry, so I want you to tell my fortune.
Oh, well, I don't know about that. It all sounds rather medical to me, and
I can pay.
It's illegal, you see, said Cutwell wretchedly. The old king expressly forbade fortune-telling and stole that. He didn't like wizards much.
I can pay a lot.
Mrs. Nugent was telling me this new girl is likely to be worse. A right haughty one, she said. Not the sort to look kindly on practitioners of the subtle arts, I fear.
Cayley smiled. Members of the court who had seen that smile before would have hastened to drag Cutwell out of the way and into a place of safety, like the next continent, but he just sat there trying to pick bits of mushroom out of his robe.
"I understand she's got a foul temper on her," said Cayley. "I wouldn't be surprised if she didn't turn you out of the city anyway."
"Oh, dear," said Cutwell. "Do you really think so?"
Look, said Cayley, you don't have to tell my future, just my present. Even she couldn't object to that. I'll have a word with her if you like, she added magnanimously.
Cutwell brightened.
Oh, do you know her? He said.
Yes, but sometimes I think not very well.
Cutwell sighed and burrowed around in the debris on the table, dislodging cascades of elderly plates and the long mummified remains of several meals. Eventually he unearthed a fat leather wallet, stuck to a cheese slice.
Well, he said doubtfully, these are the Karok cards, distilled wisdom of the ancients and all that, or there's the Ching Aling of the Hublandish. It's all the rage in the smart sect. I don't do tea leaves.
I'll try the Ching thing.
You throw these yarrow stalks in the air, then.
She did. They looked at the ensuing pattern.
Said Cutwell after a while. Well, that's one in the fireplace, one in the cocoa mug, and one in the street, shame about the window, one on the table, and one, oh no, two behind the dresser. I expect Mrs. Nugent will be able to find the rest.
You didn't say how hard. Shall I do it again?
No, I don't think so.
Cutwell thumbed through the pages of a yellowed book that had previously been supporting the table leg.
The pattern seems to make sense. Yes, here we are. Octagram 8,887. Illegality. The unatoning goose. Which we cross-reference here. Hold on. Yes, got it.
Well?
Without verticality, wisely the cochineal emperor goes forth at tea-time. At evening the mollusk is silent among the almond blossom.
Yes, said Cayley, respectfully. What does that mean?
Unless you're a mollusk, probably not a lot, said Cutwell. I think perhaps it lost something in translation.
Are you sure you know how to do this?
Let's try the cards, said Cutwell hurriedly, fanning them out. Pick a card, any card.
It's death, said Cayley.
Ah, well, of course. The death card doesn't actually mean death in all circumstances, Cutwell said quickly.
You mean it doesn't mean death in those circumstances where the subject is getting overexcited and you're too embarrassed to tell the truth, hm?
Look, take another card.
This one's death as well, said Cayley.
Did you put the other one back?
No. Shall I take another card?
May as well.
Well, there's a coincidence.
Death number three?
Right.
Is this a special pack for conjuring tricks? Cayley tried to sound composed, but even she could detect the faint tinkle of hysteria in her voice. Cutwell frowned at her and carefully put the cards back in the pack, shuffled it, and dealt them out onto the table. There was only one death.
Oh, dear, he said. I think this is going to be serious.
May I see the palm of your hand, please?
He examined it for a long time. After a while, he went to the dresser, took a jeweller's eyeglass out of a drawer, wiped the porridge off it with the sleeve of his robe, and spent another few minutes examining her hand in minutest detail. Eventually, he sat back, removed the glass, and stared at her.
"You're dead," he said.
Cayley waited. She couldn't think of any suitable reply. "I'm not," lacked a certain style, while "Is it serious?" seemed somehow too frivolous.
"Did I say I thought this was going to be serious?" said Cutwell. I think you did, said Kaylee carefully, keeping her tone totally level. I was right. Oh, it could be fatal. How much more fatal, said Kaylee, than being dead? I didn't mean for you. Oh, something very fundamental seems to have gone wrong, you see. You're dead in every sense, but the, actual. I mean, the cards think you're dead. Your lifeline thinks you're dead. Everything and everyone thinks you're dead. I don't, said Kaylee, but her voice was less than confident. I'm afraid your opinion doesn't count. But people can see and hear me. The first thing you learn when you enroll at Unseen University, I'm afraid, is that people don't pay much attention to that sort of thing. It's what the minds tell them that's important. You mean people don't see me because their minds tell them not to? Afraid so. It's called predestination or something. Cutwell looked at her wretchedly. I'm a wizard. We know about these things. Actually, it's not the first thing you learn when you enroll, he added. I mean, you learn where the lavatories are and all that sort of thing before that. But after that, it's the first thing. You can see me, though. Ah, well, wizards are specially trained to see things that are there and not to see things that aren't. You get these special exercises. Kaylee drummed her fingers on the table, or tried to. It turned out to be difficult. She stared down in vague horror. Cutwell hurried forward and wiped the table with his sleeve. Sorry, he muttered. I had treacle sandwiches for supper last night. What can I do? Nothing. Nothing? Well, you could certainly become a very successful burglar. Sorry, that was tasteless of me. I thought so. Cutwell patted her ineptly on the hand, and Kaylee was too preoccupied even to notice such flagrant lèse-majesté. You see, everything's fixed. History's all worked out from start to finish. What the facts actually are is beside the point. History just rolls straight over the top of them. You can't change anything because the changes are already part of it. You're dead. It's fated. You'll just have to accept it. He gave an apologetic grin. You're a lot luckier than most dead people, if you look at it objectively, he said. You're alive to enjoy it. I don't want to accept it. Why should I accept it? It's not my fault. You don't understand. History is moving on. You can't get involved in it anymore. There isn't a part in it for you, don't you see? Best to let things take their course. He patted her hand again. She looked at him. He withdrew his hand. What am I supposed to do then? She said. Not eat because the food wasn't destined to be eaten by me. Go and live in a crypt somewhere. Bit of a poser, isn't it? Agreed Cutwell. That's fate for you, I'm afraid. If the world can't sense you, you don't exist. I'm a wizard. We know. Don't say it. Kaylee stood up. 5 generations ago, one of her ancestors had halted his band of nomadic cutthroats a few miles from the mound of Stolat, and had regarded the sleeping city with a peculiarly determined expression that said, "This'll do. Just because you're born in the saddle doesn't mean you have to die in the bloody thing." Strangely enough, many of his distinctive features had, by a trick of heredity, been bequeathed to his descendant, accounting for her rather idiosyncratic attractiveness. Although not the droopy moustache and round furry hat with the spike on it. They were never more apparent than now. Even Cutwell was impressed. When it came to determination, you could have cracked rocks on her jaw. In exactly the same tone of voice that her ancestor had used when he addressed his weary, sweaty followers before the attack, she said, "No, no, I'm not going to accept it. I'm not going to dwindle into some sort of ghost. You're going to help me, wizard." The speech has been passed on to later generations in an epic poem commissioned by his son, who wasn't born in a saddle and could eat with a knife and fork. It began, "See yonder the stolid foeman slumber, fat with stolen gold, corrupt of mind. Let the spears of your wrath be as the steppe fire on a windy day and in dry season. Let your honest blade thrust like the horns of a 5-year-old yok with severe toothache." And went on for 3 hours. Reality, which can't usually afford to pay poets, records that, in fact, the entire speech ran, "Lads, most of them are still in bed. We should go through them like Xac fruit through a short grandmother. And I, for one, have had it right up to here with yurts. Okay?" Cutwell's subconscious recognised that tone. It had harmonics in it that made even the woodworm in the floorboards stop what they were doing and stand to attention. It wasn't voicing an opinion. It was saying, things will be thus.
"Me, madam," he quavered. "I don't see what I can possibly do."
He was jerked off his chair and out into the street, his robes billowing around him. Kaylee marched towards the palace with her shoulders set determinedly, dragging the wizard behind her like a reluctant puppy. It was with such a walk that mothers used to bear down on the local school when the little boy came home with a black eye. It was unstoppable. It was like the march of time.
"What is it you intend?"
Cutwell stuttered, horribly aware that there was going to be nothing he could do to resist, whatever it was.
"It's your lucky day, wizard."
"Oh, good," he said weakly.
"You've just been appointed Royal Recognizer."
"Oh, what does that entail exactly?"
"You're going to remind everyone I'm alive. It's very simple. There's 3 square meals a day and your laundry done. Step lively, man."
"Royal?
You're a wizard. I think there's something you ought to know," said the princess.
"There is," said Death.
That was a cinematic trick adapted for print. Death wasn't talking to the princess, he was actually in his study talking to Mort. But it was quite effective, wasn't it? It probably called a fast dissolve, or a cross-cut zoom, or something. An industry where a senior technician is called a best boy might call it anything.
"And what is that?"
he added, winding a bit of black silk around the wicked hook in a little vice he'd clamped to his desk. Mort hesitated. Mostly this was because of fear and embarrassment, but it was also because the sight of a hooded spectre peacefully tying dry flies was enough to make anyone pause. Besides, Isabel was sitting on the other side of the room, ostensibly doing some needlework, but also watching him through a cloud of sullen disapproval. He could feel her red-rimmed eyes boring into the back of his head. Death inserted a few crow hackles and whistled a busy little tune through his teeth, not having anything else to whistle through. He looked up.
"They didn't go as smoothly as I thought," said Mort, standing nervously on the carpet in front of the desk.
"You had trouble," said Death, snipping off a few scraps of feather.
"Well, you see, the witch wouldn't come away, and the monk, well, he started out all over again."
"There's nothing to worry about there, lad."
"Mort,
you should have worked out by now that everyone gets what they think is coming to them. It's so much neater that way."
"I know, sir, but that means bad people who think they're going to some sort of paradise actually do get there, and good people who fear they're going to some kind of horrible place really suffer. It doesn't seem like justice."
"What is it I've said you must remember when you're out on the duty?"
"Well, you..."
Mort stuttered into silence.
"There's no justice. There's just you."
"Well, I..."
"You must remember that."
"Yes, but..."
"I expect it all works out properly in the end. I have never met the Creator, but I'm told he's quite kindly disposed to people."
Death snapped the thread and started to unwind the vice.
"Put such thoughts out of your mind," he added. "At least the third one shouldn't have given you any trouble."
This was the moment. Mort had thought about it for a long time. There was no sense in concealing it. He'd upset the whole future course of history. Such things tend to draw themselves to people's attention. Best to get it off his chest. Own up like a man. Take his medicine. Cards on table. Beating about bush, none of. Mercy, throw himself on. The piercing blue eyes glittered at him. He looked back like a nocturnal rabbit trying to outstare the headlights of a 16-wheeled Arctic whose driver is a 12-hour caffeine freak out running the tachometers of hell. He failed.
"No, sir," he said.
"Good. Well done. Now then, what do you think of this?"
Anglers reckon that a good dry fly should cunningly mimic the real thing. There are the right flies for morning, there are different flies for the evening rise, and so on. But the thing between Death's triumphant digits was a fly from the dawn of time. It was the fly in the primordial soup. It had bred on mammoth turds. It wasn't a fly that bangs on window panes. It was a fly that drills through walls. It was an insect that would crawl out from between the slats of the heaviest swat-dripping venom and seeking revenge. Strange wings and dangling bits stuck out all over it. It seemed to have a lot of teeth.
"What's it called?" said Mort.
"I shall call it Death's Glory."
Death gave the thing a final admiring glance and stuck it into the hood of his robe.
"I feel inclined to see a little bit of life this evening," he said. "You can take the duty now that you've got the hang of it, as it were."
"Yes, sir," said Mort mournfully. He saw his life stretching out in front of him like a nasty black tunnel with no light at the end of it. Death drummed his finger on the desk, muttered to himself.
"Ah, yes," he said. "Albert tells me someone's been meddling in the library."
"Pardon, sir?"
"Taking books out, leaving them lying around. Books about young women. He seems to think it's amusing."
As has already been revealed, the holy listeners have such well-developed hearing that they can be deafened by a good sunset. Just for a few seconds it seemed to Mort that the skin on the back of his neck was developing similar strange powers, because he could see Isabel freeze in mid-stitch. He also heard the little intake of breath that he'd heard before among the shelves. He remembered the lace handkerchief. He said,
"Yes, sir. It won't happen again, sir."
The skin on the back of his neck started to itch like fury.
"Splendid. Now you two can run along. Get Albert to do you a picnic lunch or something. Get some fresh air. I've noticed the way you two always avoid each other."
He gave Mort a conspiratorial nudge. It was like being poked with a stick, and added,
"Albert's told me what that means."
"Has he?" said Mort gloomily. He'd been wrong. There was a light at the end of the tunnel, and it was a flamethrower.
Death gave him another of his supernova winks. Mort didn't return it. Instead, he turned and plodded towards the door, at a general speed and gait that made Great Artuin look like a spring lamb. He was halfway along the corridor before he heard the soft rush of footsteps behind him, and a hand caught his arm.
"Mort?"
He turned and gazed at Isabel through the fog of depression.
"Why did you let him think it was you in the library?"
"Don't know."
"It was very kind of you," she said cautiously.
"Was it? I can't think what came over me."
He felt in his pocket and produced the handkerchief.
"This belongs to you, I think."
"Thank you."
She blew her nose noisily. Mort was already well down the corridor, his shoulders hunched like a vulture's wings. She ran after him.
"I say," she said.
"What?"
"I wanted to say thank you."
"It doesn't matter," he muttered. "It'd just be best if you don't take books away again. It upsets them or something."
He gave what he considered to be a mirthless laugh.
"Huh."
"Huh, what?"
"Just...
He'd reached the end of the corridor. There was the door into the kitchen where Albert would be leering knowingly, and Mort decided he couldn't face that. He stopped.
"But I only took the books for a bit of company," she said, behind him.
He gave in.
"We could have a walk in the garden," he said in despair, and then managed to harden his heart a little and added, "without obligation, that is."
"You mean you're not going to marry me?" she said.
Mort was horrified.
"Marry?
Isn't that what Father brought you here for?" she said. "He doesn't need an apprentice, after all."
"You mean all those nudges and winks and little comments about some day my son all this will be yours?" said Mort. "I tried to ignore them. I don't want to get married to anyone yet," he added, suppressing a fleeting mental picture of the princess. "And certainly not to you, no offence meant."
"I wouldn't marry you if you were the last man on the disc," she said sweetly.
Mort was hurt by this. It was one thing not to want to marry someone, but quite another to be told that they didn't want to marry you.
"At least I don't look like I've been eating donuts in a wardrobe for years," he said, as they stepped out onto Death's back lawn.
"At least I walk as if my legs only had one knee each," she said.
"My eyes aren't two jergly poached eggs."
Isabel nodded.
"On the other hand, my ears don't look like something growing on a dead tree.
What does jergly mean?"
"You know, eggs like Albert does them."
"With the white all sticky and runny and full of slimy bits?"
"Yes."
"Good word," she conceded thoughtfully. "But my hair, I put it to you, doesn't look like something you clean a privy with."
"Certainly, but neither does mine look like a wet hedgehog.
Pray note that my chest does not appear to be a toast rack in a wet paper bag."
Mort glanced sideways at the top of Isabel's dress, which contained enough puppy fat for two litters of Rottweilers, and forbore to comment.
"My eyebrows don't look like a pair of mating caterpillars," he hazarded.
"True, but my legs, I suggest, could at least stop a pig in a passageway."
"Sorry?"
"They're not bandy," she explained.
"Ah."
They strolled through the lily beds, temporarily lost for words. Eventually, Isabel confronted Mort and stuck out her hand. He shook it in thankful silence.
"Enough," she said.
"Just about."
"Good. Obviously we shouldn't get married, if only for the sake of the children."
Mort nodded. They sat down on a stone seat between some neatly clipped box hedges. Death had made a pond in this corner of the garden, fed by an icy spring that appeared to be vomited into the pool by a stone lion. Fat white carp lurked in the depths, or nosed on the surface among the velvety black water lilies.
"We should have brought some breadcrumbs," said Mort gallantly, opting for a totally non-controversial subject.
"He never comes out here, you know," said Isabel, watching the fish. "He made it to keep me amused."
"It didn't work?"
"It's not real," she said. "Nothing's real here, not really real. He just likes to act like a human being. He's trying really hard at the moment. Have you noticed? I think you're having an effect on him. Did you know he tried to learn the banjo once?"
"I see him as more the organ type."
"He couldn't get the hang of it," said Isabel, ignoring him. "He can't create, you see."
"You said he created this pool."
"It's a copy of one he saw somewhere. Everything's a copy."
Mort shifted uneasily. Some small insect had crawled up his leg.
"It's rather sad," he said, hoping that this was approximately the right tone to adopt.
"Yes."
She scooped a handful of gravel from the path and began to flick it absent-mindedly into the pool.
"Are my eyebrows that bad?" she said.
Said Mort. "'Fraid so."
"Oh."
Flick. Flick.
The carp were watching her disdainfully.
"And my legs," he said.
"Yes. Sorry."
Mort shuffled anxiously through his limited repertoire of small talk and gave up.
"Never mind," he said gallantly. "At least you can use tweezers."